Nicholas Segarra and Hooray for the Riff Raff performing their song Palante at Democracy Now's 30th anniversary on Monday at the historic Riverside Church here in New York. To watch the full event, go to democracynow.org. It included Angela Davis, Bruce Springsteen, Michael Stipe, Aaron Dessner, Masab Abu-Toha, V, Juan Gonzalez, Nermeen Sheikh, and more. Check it out at democracynow.org. And the film about Democracy Now's 30 years is opening in New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and more. You can check it all out, stealthisstory.org. We will be doing Q&As at all the theaters. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
Earth Day is around the corner. Celebrate with KBOO at our Earth Day tree planting open house, April 22nd, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mingle with other Earth-conscious radio heads, enjoy snacks and drinks, and become a part of KBOO's roots. That's April 22nd, 11 a.m., at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, for KBOO's Earth Day Tree Planting Open House.
What is climate change? How is it affecting our lives? And what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots, from energy to extreme weather, public health, and more. I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerowitz. Join me for Climate Connections during the evening news, weekdays at 5 p.m. here on 90.7 KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, dozens of rallies are planned across Oregon for a No Kings Day of Action on Saturday.
Portland protesters at the ICE facility in southwest Portland are at risk of being tear-gassed again, thanks to a new emergency order.
And the strike at Portland Community College could soon impact the visas of international students.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 27th, 2026. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Thousands of Oregonians are expected to take to the streets for a No Kings Day of Protest on Saturday, March 28th, across the state. At a similar rally in October of last year, some 40,000 people rallied at the Portland waterfront. A dozen rallies are planned across Portland, with more reaching all parts of the state from Port Orford to Prineville. In the metro area at 10 a.m., Portland labor activists will gather at the convention center to hear speakers, including the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO and Governor Tina Kotek. That rally, along with others dotted at corners around town, will feed into a larger event at the Portland waterfront scheduled to begin at noon. No Kings rallies were first organized in June and again in October last year. 7 million people joined in over 2,000 events across all 50 states. On their website, they highlight key issues with the Trump regime, including sending masked ICE agents to terrorize communities, gutting health care, environmental protections and education, undermining democracy, and spending billions to start foreign wars. Organizers write on the website, quote, "The president thinks his rule is absolute, but in America, we don't have kings and we won't back down against chaos, corruption, and cruelty," end quote.
Oregon leaders are alarmed by a federal court hold that allows ICE agents to again tear gas Portlanders outside the facility in the South Waterfront neighborhood. Two separate cases were decided against ICE in the last month, limiting their ability to tear gas protesters. One was on the basis of the chemical agents suppressing freedom of speech. The other charged that the tear gas violated the bodily autonomy of the residents of a nearby apartment building, who became ill from being inundated with gas and couldn't leave their homes. Judges found officers used excessive force against nonviolent protesters and showed, quote, "deliberate indifference about how many chemicals they unleashed on the neighborhood." As of Wednesday, both of those blocks are on hold for further review by the entire Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Simply put, the judicial limits on ICE's usage of tear gas are not currently in effect. For local leaders, that's worrying, especially ahead of the massive demonstrations planned for Saturday. During the October No Kings demonstration, some protesters went to the ICE building and were met with several rounds of tear gas from federal officers. The emergency hold is temporary until the entire Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals can hear both cases against ICE's tear gas use. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson's office told the Oregonian, quote, "We must hope protecting the rights of people peacefully exercising these rights ultimately prevails," end quote. Portland's own police have been banned from using tear gas on protesters since 2020.
Half of the workers who were on strike at Portland Community College now have a tentative agreement, but while the faculty are still on the picket line, hundreds of international students are in limbo. The three-week strike impacts all students, their graduation timelines, their financial aid, and their income from on-campus jobs. But for international students studying at PCC, the classes they attend are the key to allowing them to stay in the United States. They go through a complicated and often restrictive visa process, and they must be full-time students to keep their F1 visas. These students must be in class full-time by April 22nd, or they'll have to leave the country within 2 weeks or face deportation. International students face a tough choice: transfer colleges or leave the country. Many of them started their studies before President Trump created more restrictive travel bans on 40 countries, so they may not be able to return. It can be difficult to transfer to another college. To do so, these students need to show that they have the money to pay for an entire school year. That can be hard to do on short notice. Some of their options may be far-flung and difficult to reach via public transit, which is a common way for international students to get around. PCC workers in the International Affairs Office say they tried to warn students ahead of time and worry about the future of international students at the college in general. Stephanie Njenga is an international student from Kenya. She says she didn't think the strike would last that long or really impact her status, but she told the Portland Mercury, quote, "As time goes by, I become more concerned because what are they thinking? Are they not thinking about us? As time goes by, you start having doubts about the administration," end quote. Unionized classified staff at PCC reached a tentative agreement with the administration on Thursday, but the faculty union is still on strike.
A new report updating the data on family caregivers in Washington state finds that people caring for their aging loved ones contribute about $25 billion worth of unpaid care per year. The report from AARP highlights the central role that caregivers play in sustaining the state's long-term care system. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Family caregivers in Washington state provide an estimated $25 billion worth of unpaid care each year, according to a new report from AARP. The report, called Valuing the Invaluable, found about 1.2 million people in Washington care for an aging loved one, assisting with everything from rides to appointments to complex medical tasks like injections. Kathleen McCall with AARP Washington calls family caregivers the unsung heroes of the state's long-term care system.
Without family caregivers, our long-term care system falls apart. And AARP is really trying to capture that with data to paint a picture of how critical family caregivers are to our overall long-term care system.
McCall says that without caregivers, many more Washington residents would be forced to rely on paid in-home care or costly institutional care, increasing expenses for families, taxpayers, and public programs. While there is room for improvement, McCall says Washington has done more than other states to support family caregivers. She points to WaCares, the nation's first publicly funded long-term care insurance program that is launching in July. People who pay into the program will be able to access things like in-home care, home modifications, and meals. But she says, especially with a rapidly aging population, the need for family caregivers is not going away anytime soon.
There is really no way that the state would ever be able to pay for the services that these family caregivers provide.
One of the biggest challenges facing caregivers, according to McCall, is knowing where to turn for help. She says the state offers a variety of supports, including through the local offices of the Area Agency on Aging. She says people can access more resources through the AARP website. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
President Donald Trump justifies his use of a mail-in ballot. Voting rights advocates say the Save America Act will disenfranchise voters with disabilities, and more people are losing faith in the American dream. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Because of the fact that I'm president of the United States, I did a mail-in ballot for elections that took place in Florida because I felt I should be here instead of being in the beautiful sunshine.
President Donald Trump has objected to mail-in voting, but says he used it for the Florida primary because his responsibilities kept him in Washington. One of his top legislative priorities, the Save America Act, would strip that right from most. The strict voter ID law would require in-person registration, and a driver's license alone wouldn't suffice as identification. It would only allow for mail-in voting if someone is in a hospital, in the military, or made plans ahead of time to be away from home on election day. Voting rights groups say it would effectively disenfranchise entire populations. Mallory Hudson with the Keystone Progress Education Fund says people with disabilities have more trouble traveling to register or vote. Plus, she says they're more likely to be in poverty and may be unable to afford documents like a passport or birth certificate.
A lot of people who live in Pennsylvania's skilled nursing facilities have their care covered by Medicaid, which means they have a monthly personal needs allowance of only $60. This is like 70% of people living in nursing facilities across Pennsylvania.
Meanwhile, the White House is giving mixed messages about the state of negotiations with Iran. While Trump says the country is begging for a deal, Tehran's public demands are taking a hard line, calling for security guarantees and reparations for damages. Trump has again granted an extension in his threats to bomb Iran's power infrastructure unless it reopens the Strait of Hormuz. With some airport wait times exceeding 3 hours and Congress failing to reach a DHS funding deal, Trump says he'll sign an emergency executive order to pay TSA agents. Security agents are resigning en masse while going unpaid during the third government shutdown in 6 months. It's unclear how the executive order would work, although money for TSA is still being collected from fees on flights. Organizers say there will be thousands of No Kings protests this weekend. Events in Minnesota may draw added attention given the immigration crackdown there that resulted in federal agents killing two protesters. Rain Headland of New London plans to attend an event in Wilmar, the county seat, which is a quarter Latino.
Wilmar has a large immigrant community. They help our community thrive and are a huge part of a lot of really positive things happening in the community.
The White House continues arguing its actions are popular, but polls contradict that. One survey puts Trump's approval rating below any point in either term, and separate research finds people think things in the country are getting worse. One Marquette survey found three-quarters of Wisconsinites very concerned about inflation and the cost of living. Washington University professor Mark Rank says higher costs and stagnant wages make some say the American dream is out of reach.
This idea of more and more people falling behind in terms of the American dream really explains a lot of the disillusionment, a lot of the frustration, a lot of the anxiety people are experiencing in this country today.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In Montana, a wildfire killed tens of thousands of trees on one rancher's property. In the aftermath, they buried the dead trees to lock away climate pollution in a promising new strategy. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 5 years ago, a wildfire tore through Rebecca Gentry's Montana ranch, leaving tens of thousands of dead, scorched trees in its wake. In situations like this, landowners sometimes clean up pasture land by cutting the dead standing trees, piling them up, and burning them so they don't fall and hurt people or animals. But that releases the climate-warming CO2 the trees absorbed as they grew.
And that's what we want to help landowners avoid.
Grant Canary is CEO of the company Mass Reforestation, which worked with Gentry on a different solution. They dug a pit about 20 feet deep, buried millions of pounds of dead trees, and capped the vault with fabric, gravel, and soil. Then they replanted the ground above with native grasses for grazing cattle. Research shows that burying wood underground can slow its decomposition.
In the right conditions, the carbon is locked into the soil for hundreds, if not thousands of years, taking advantage of all the hard work that the trees did over decades to remove that carbon from the atmosphere.
At the Montana Ranch, the vault will be closely monitored to ensure that it's locking away global warming emissions long term. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it'll be Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 38 degrees, and tomorrow's weather will be cloudy also with a daytime high of about 59. Today in history, in 1866, President of the United States of America, Andrew Johnson, vetoes the Civil Rights Act of 1866. His veto is overridden by Congress, and the bill passes into law on April 9th. The act was the first federal law to define citizenship and affirm that all citizens have equal protection under the law. This came in the wake of the Civil War and was intended to protect the civil rights of African Americans. It was not until the mid-1900s that Congress would put teeth behind civil rights law. The intervening repressive years became known as the Jim Crow era. The quote of the day is from French poet Alfred de Vigny, born this day in 1797. He said, quote, "History is a novel whose author is the people."
A California bill seeks a formal apology from the state legislature and the courts for their role in atrocities against First Peoples. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A bill in the California legislature seeks a formal apology to Native Americans for the state's role in atrocities committed against Native people during the formation of the state, including forced removal from their lands, bounties for their heads, and other violence. Native American Assembly member James Ramos introduced the bill seeking the apology from the legislature and courts. The bill also requires a plaque to be displayed in the state capitol to memorialize the apology. Ramos notes Governor Gavin Newsom issued a formal apology in 2019, but the legislature and courts have yet to apologize, which he says is a stain on California's history. He says California's First People deserve an apology for the harm they endured and the generational trauma that continues today. The bill is supported by tribes and Native organizations in the state. You can count on it like the steady beat of a Native drum. Once a week, Yupik dancers fill the lobby at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage to lift the spirits of patients. And as KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the kids are the ones to watch.
These days, we mostly see Alaska Native dance groups on a stage. But in the hospital lobby, the dancing is not meant to be a performance. Instead, a shared experience. The rhythms are almost hypnotic. Yet the dancers are fully present. Everyone is seated within a circle of sound and motion that spirals out from a small group of drummers.
In Yupik, we say you rock, not dance.
Kyle Watson is 12 years old, a sixth grader. He's here every Wednesday. His movements are sharp and precise, as if every fiber of his being snaps to the beat of the drum.
It just makes me happy.
Once Kyle is here, he says, any anger or sadness fades away. The Yuhak demands his full attention.
I keep on learning more about Yupik words, and I keep on learning more about dance motions too.
And then it's as if he's channeling something from another time and place. The excitement that comes out of Kyle's throat comes from way down deep. A throwback to a technique his ancestors used to excite the dancers and encourage them to pick up their pace. Kyle's grandfather, Percy Alexi, usually stands in the back of the room to watch.
I'm proud of him. He makes it fun. And I'm proud to say he taught himself. He taught himself.
Kids in their most pure form can do anything, and they could never do wrong.
Asi Gayakayak says this dance gathering is going on its 16th year, and by far, the best part is watching kids like Kyle. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And this is my final sign-off for National Native News. After more than 20 years at Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, I'd like to thank all the tribal and public radio stations, stringers, and especially to the listeners. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Schools across New England have partnered with national nonprofit Sandy Hook Promise to expand access to violence prevention training programs. More than 50 districts across Massachusetts are using its Say Something anonymous reporting system, which students can rely on when they need a trusted adult. Catherine Carley has more.
More New England schools are working with national nonprofit Sandy Hook Promise to help students recognize safety threats or a classmate in need of help. More than 75 schools in Massachusetts alone are using its Say Something anonymous reporting system, which allows students to share a concern 24 hours a day via text, phone, or a school's website. Lisa Golden is the safety director for Salem Public Schools.
Families and students were asking us, if I have a problem and I can't find a trusted adult, who can I go to if I have a problem? If I know that another student's having a problem or they're struggling with something.
She says students have used the system when they feel depressed or worried they may harm themselves. Sandy Hook Promise says the system has helped more than 5,000 students nationwide cope with a mental health crisis and saved more than 1,000 lives. Educators say Sandy Hook Promise programs help create more of what they refer to as upstanders, students who witness bullying or harmful behavior and choose to report the incident rather than look the other way. Stickers on classroom doors and hallway posters remind students of the resources available to them. Golden says students also have a button on their personal laptops they can push to send their concerns to a counselor.
I think a lot of students see it as one more place to go if I have to go and tell somebody something that I just don't want to say out loud in class, or I don't know who to turn to because my friend is posting stuff online at 10:30 at night and I'm really worried.
Golden says Salem Public Schools began training with Sandy Hook Promise in 2024 and that this will be the first full school year the program is utilized. She credits district leadership for partnering with Sandy Hook Promise and providing ample training to both educators and students, calling it an important addition to the school's culture. This story is based on original reporting by Emily Miranda Aguilar with Capital News Service. I'm Catherine Carley with New England News Service.
A bill being reintroduced today in Congress would codify support for the National Parent and Youth Helpline. Suzanne Potter has more.
Today, California Congresswoman Norma Torres is reintroducing the National Parent and Youth Helpline Act, which would codify and greatly expand the service. The bill would dedicate $20 million a year for 5 years to the program, which aims to help the 174 million parents and kids in the U.S. Dr. Lisa Pion Berlin is president and CEO of Parents Anonymous, based in L.A., the organization that runs the free helpline.
So the helpline will connect people to another human being, a trained clinician, to provide evidence-based emotional support on any issue, with a focus on preventing child abuse and neglect.
People can call or text the helpline 24/7 at 855-427-2736 or live chat on the group's website, nationalparentyouthhelpline.org. The bill would also fund online support groups. Pine Berlin says the helpline has served more than 77,000 callers since it started in 2024 and has provided resources to more than 1 million people on a range of issues, including depression, financial problems, bullying, community violence, suicidal thoughts, and more. Representative Torres first introduced the bill in 2024, where it sat in a House committee. She spent 17 years as a 911 dispatcher in Los Angeles and says parents and kids out there are hurting.
It is critically important. We can avoid calls to 911. We can prevent child abuse, and we can prevent police officers from having to respond.
The bill would allow the existing helpline to hire more trained counselors to answer the phones, which Torres says would reduce wait times. Right now, it's estimated that up to 40% of callers get frustrated and hang up while on hold. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Now, it's time for the Point Puzzle, the weekly radio brain teaser created by Pearl Stark at KPOV in Bend. On this week's puzzle, wordplay, girls' names, and fabric.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to start with a flower and two foods. Swap two letters and then combine the foods. You now have two names that you may have heard the prior weekend. Well, the answer is begonia, ham, and nut, which becomes begonia and hamnet, both nominated for Best Picture. We had no correct answers this week. When you know the rules, it's so easy. All you have to do is fall in love. Play the game. Everybody play the game. For the new puzzle, take two old-fashioned girls' names in two syllables each. Stick them together, and phonetically, you have a fabric invented in the 1900s. So again, take two old-fashioned girls' names, two syllables each, stick them together, and phonetically, you have a fabric invented in the 1900s. When you have an answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Rowena was an artist's daughter, the deeper image shook her up. Dee's mother left her father, took his money and his truck. Debbie Ray had no such problems, perfect Norman Rockwell home. Nina, 16, had a baby, left her parents, lived alone. Bobby joined the New Wave band, changed her name to Bobby.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of March 23rd. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 27th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, Pearl Stark, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The Director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Robert Barncord. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin. Thank you.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Sunshine Week, based on a popular statement from Louis Brandeis that sunlight is the best disinfectant, is an effort to spotlight open government and its importance to the public's right to know what's being done in our name. The Michigan Press Association usually honors a public official that advances open government during Sunshine Week, but this year they said they're not giving an award because, quote, this year's legislative and policy